Please be seated, folks.
Good morning to all. We're here for another day of proceedings in the Omnibus Autism Proceeding Theory 2 trial. We've got a couple of matters to talk about, or at least one before we go on the record. And that is the time of starting for tomorrow. Do you have a time yet, Mr. Matanosky, when Dr. Rust will be here?
Yes, sir. We should be all right if we start at 10. All right with the court.
Well, so just a notice to the folks listening at home, tomorrow we will not be starting till 10 o'clock with the testimony. Let's go ahead and go on the record then. We have a housekeeping matter that we need to take care of. As you heard the other day, we had some presentations by both parties about how to handle the rebuttal evidence in this case and the issue of how to handle the testimony in the third case and the rebuttal. Last evening, after the close of proceedings on the record, we did have additional discussion of that. Both counsel for both parties made presentations on that, and we discussed it, and Special Master Vau is going to explain our ruling on that, on those issues.
Essentially, our ruling is this. We've asked the respondent to continue presenting its case in chief on both the theory A and theory B of theory 2, the second theory of causation. To put on all of their witnesses now, with the exception of the two that we've already discussed, Drs. Clarkson and Magos, who are not available until July. Petitioner will put on the rebuttal case in this coming week and a half at the conclusion of the government's case to what they've already heard from the government. We are scheduled to have further proceedings then on the Theory 2 omnibus matters, the general causation matters, and to hear the third test case-specific information in the third week of July. We will allot 2 days to testimony on the specific new test case, 2 days to the government to present the two toxicologists and whatever is left of the second day that petitioners have, or the beginning of the third day, to hear their case-specific, I assume, pediatric neurologist, whether it's Dr. Rust or someone else. And Friday will be reserved to the petitioners to provide rebuttal to Drs. Clarkson and Magos, but we will strictly enforce that it has to be rebutting what Drs. Clarkson and Magos testified to, not the general, not the gamut of what we've heard or what we will hear in the next week and a half. Does that comport with my recitation of the ruling last evening?
From petitioners, then, that's an accurate recitation, Special Master.
And Mr. Matanosky, you looked a little confused.
No, ma'am. Actually, that comports exactly with what I understood the ruling to be when we convened, when we spoke last evening. I just wanted to, for the record, as far as in another proceeding, earlier in this omnibus trial, we had a rebuttal close at the end of that proceeding, and then there was some written submissions thereafter. And I just wanted to make sure that that's not the process that we're adopting here today, but rather in this process, the rebuttal is going to end at the end of this trial.
That is my fervent hope, Mr. Matanosky.
Thank you.
All right. Well, with that matter having been discussed, I guess it's time to go to the next government witness, Mr. Matanosky.
Thank you.
At this time, the government is going to call Dr. Jackson Roberts.
Dr. Roberts, please have a seat, and we'll ask you to raise your right hand. Please, do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give us will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, to help you guys?
I do.
Please go ahead, Ms. Renzi.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning, Dr. Roberts.
Good morning.
Could you please state your name for the record?
L. Jackson Roberts II, MD.
Dr. Roberts, we wonder if you could, to the extent possible, sit to your right there. Please don't go off the edge of the podium there, but it would be easier for us to see you. And do keep your voice up so we can hear you.
Ms. Ramsey, go ahead.
I think you're fine.
Okay.
Now, I noticed that we've just been given a handout to go with Dr. Roberts' testimony. We should mark that, I assume, as Respondents Trial Exhibit 6,
yes.
Ms. Ramsey. All right.
Dr. Roberts, could you briefly describe your educational background, starting with your bachelor's degree?
I got a BA degree from Cornell College in 1969, and then I went on to the University of Iowa, where I got an MD degree. I subsequently went on to Wharton University in St. Louis, where I did internal medicine residency, board certified in internal medicine. And then I went to Vanderbilt University to take a fellowship in clinical pharmacology, where I've remained since.
And you became when did you become a full professor at Vanderbilt?
Around 1986.
And then in 2006, you became a T. Edwin Professor of Pharmacology. Could you please explain what that is?
That's an endowed chair that was given to me by the university. Endowed chairs give money to particular professors who've had a long track record of accomplishments to give them some latitude. So it's a very prestigious thing.
Dr. Roberts, if you could do your best to speak up,
okay.
Perhaps a little slower too, but we're having a little difficulty hearing you, but
okay.
Speak up as loud as you can, please.
And Dr. Roberts, I'm going to put on this screen, it's right there in front of you, portion of your curriculum vitae that was filed as Respondents Exhibit DD. And this section is called the Academic and Professional Honors. Could you please describe your awards?
Well, when I was in medical school, I was elected to Alpha Omega Alpha, which is AOA Society, which is like Phi Beta Kappa in normal universities. In 1983, I received a Burroughs Wellcome Scholar Award in clinical pharmacology, and then in 2001, I received a Sidney Kalowick Faculty Research Award from Vanderbilt. Then I was elected to two of the sort of prestigious societies in medicine, and you have to be elected, which is American Society for Clinical Investigation and Association of American Physicians. 2001, I received a merit award from the National Institutes of Health. That's a very, very prestigious award that they only give out a few of those. And they give them out to certain scientists who've had a long track record of very successful funding and accomplishments to allow them normal research grants. The maximum you can have is 5 years. So this goes for 10 years, and it doesn't have to be renewed after 5 years. You just tell them what you're going to do. So they're putting their confidence that because of your track record, they give you this latitude for 10 years of funding. Then in 2006, I got the Discovery Award from the Society for Free Radical Biology and Medicine. This was basically for our discoveries, which I think we'll talk about a little bit later, compounds of lipid oxidation called isoprostanes. And then the same year, I received the Earl Sutherland Prize for Achievement in Research in Vanderbilt University. This is not just a medical school competition, it's university-wide. It's a very, very prestigious award. And then we talked about receiving the T. Edwin Rogers Chair in Pharmacology. And then last year, I also received a Distinguished Alumni Award from the University of Iowa School of Medicine.
Thank you. And Dr. Roberts, do you currently sit on any editorial boards?
I'm associate editor of the journal called Free Radical Biology and Medicine.
And what are your duties as the associate editor?
Well, journals have editorial boards of particular individuals who will usually agree to review papers. The editors sort of sit above the editorial boards. When somebody submits a paper for publication, it comes into the journal and it's assigned to, I think we have four associate editors, one of the associate editors. So it comes to me, I take a look at it, I decide a couple of very excellent potential reviewers to review this paper, including myself looking at the paper. We send it out for review. We get the reviews back from experts. I look at those reviews and my own opinion about the paper, and I make the ultimate decision whether this paper should be published or rejected.
Now, Dr. Roberts, we're going to show you a slide up on the screen. This is slide 2. And it's a description of it's a list of your current funding and grants. Could you please go through those?
The first grant is a very large grant that's been going on in our division with Jason Morris, head of our division. He's a principal investigator. It keeps, it's been going on for about 25, 28 years now, I believe. So there's multiple investigators involved in this, and I have one project in that. The next grant, that 5R37, GM40256, that's my merit award, as I've already discussed. The next one is a grant from National Institute of Aging, and that's another grant where I'm principal investigator, and that I'm dealing with investigating the role of oxidative injury in Alzheimer's disease. The third one I'm also principal investigator on, and that involves investigating the role of oxidative damage and cardiac arrhythmias. The last two were just grants from other people in which I'm sort of a co-investigator on.
And the amounts on that funding chart, are those annual amounts?
Yes.
And the next to the annual amounts, we see 1.2 calendar months, 6 calendar months. What do those numbers represent?
Those are sort of, if you add up, for example, if you look at the second one, 6 calendar months means that I'm spending half of my time a year on that grant, and then it's split up by 1.2, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And do you run a lab at Vanderbilt?
Yeah.
And do you supervise people in your lab?
Yes.
How many?
I've got 4 research assistants. I'm also mentoring a junior faculty member and 1 PhD student.
You also hold several patents, which are listed on pages 6 and 7 of your CV. And I think we're going to bring up another slide, which is slide 3. Could you briefly describe just the patents that are related or relevant to your testimony today?
Well, these are all sort of general titles, but they all have to do with specific patents related to oxidative stress or slash injury.
And Dr. Roberts, you've published over 340 peer-reviewed articles, abstracts, and book chapters. Is that correct?
Correct.
And of these papers and book chapters, approximately 180 are in the area of oxidative stress?
Correct.
And since 1990, have all your papers been, or almost all your papers, been in the area of oxidative stress?
Correct.
And do you give presentations on the topic of oxidative stress and oxidative injury?
Many.
Could you just describe where you've been asked to present?
I've been asked to present at several international meetings regarding oxidative stress. About 4 years ago, I was also the keynote speaker on the first European workshop on isoprostanes, which is in France. And we have annual meetings for Society of Free Radical Biology and Medicine. I presented there numerous times.
Now, prior to you exclusively studying oxidative stress, your research focused primarily on prostaglandins. And I'd like you just to tell us how your research in prostaglandins led you into the area of oxidative stress.
Well, to describe what prostaglandins are, prostaglandins are small lipid molecules, and prostaglandins are made by the enzyme that's inhibited by drugs like aspirin. And we had discovered that one prostaglandin called prostaglandin D2 is metabolized to prostaglandins, what we call an F-type ring, or F-type prostaglandins. And for various reasons, there should be several different isomers of these. And when we were looking, trying to analyze for these F-ring metabolites of prostaglandin D2 by mass spectrometry in normal humans, the levels consistently, drawing blood from several people in the lab or whatever, were consistently around 30 picograms per ml. And we happened to take a plasma from a normal person that had been in our minus 20 freezer for several months. Of note that at minus 20 freezer, things are not solid ice and chemical reactions can happen even in the freezer. But what we saw with mass spectrometry, we saw the identical same compounds by mass spectrometry, but now the levels were in the thousands. And this was, what in the world's going on here? And so we were running around the department getting samples from the freezers, and they were always in the thousands. But consistently, if we drew blood from normal people, they were always around 30 or 40 picograms. And to make a long story short, I even submitted a grant to the NIH with a rational hypothesis to explain this, still related to prostaglandins, thinking these were still prostaglandins. That turned out not to be the right hypothesis, but we did figure it out. And what we figured out was what was happening in the freezer was simple oxidation of the precursor, which is a lipid arachidonic acid. So we were generating these prostaglandin-like compounds in the freezer without this cyclooxygenase enzyme that normally makes these drugs like aspirin inhibit. So basically, this was just a free radical oxidative oxidation of arachidonic acid going on in the freezer. But then the obvious question is this happening in our body? And what we subsequently showed, yes, in fact, it is. So at that point, I sort of looked back on the prostaglandin field, looked ahead in the oxidative free radical field, and I said the free radical field, it looks more interesting, probably more relevant to human disease, so I switched fields.
And during that process is when you discovered the isoprostanes, correct?
That's what these compounds have returned.
And what has been the impact of your discovery on the area of oxidative stress in the research that has followed?
I think it's been pretty profound in that at the time... Let me get a glass of water. You get a breath. So sort of about the time that we made this discovery, people in the free radical field had done... A lot of chemists were in the free radical field trying to understand in a test tube all these chemical reactions that free radicals can do. And it's a lot of elegant chemistry. And then people start asking the question, does this chemistry happen in humans? And does it happen, is it involved in the pathogenesis of various and sundry human diseases? So people developed certain analytical methods to assess that. And the problem is, at the time... most of these methods were very unreliable or nonspecific. And so there was a problem at that time of translating all this elegant chemistry to see whether it actually happens in the body, and secondly, is it plays a role in the cause of any human disease. So when we discovered these compounds, these F2 isoprostanes, for the first few years after this discovery, it appeared that maybe measuring these compounds appeared to be probably the most reliable way to assess oxidative stress status or oxidative injury in the body. And it was about 4 years ago it was published. So this was then independently confirmed. We actually asked National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences. They set up an independent sort of study, which they call the BOSS study, Biomarkers of Oxidative Stress Status, where essentially they set up a very well-accepted model of very, very, very severe oxidative injury to the liver in vivo. And they took samples of liver, et cetera, and plasma, and sent these around to investigators all around the country who all had different methods or assays to assess oxidative stress. What came out of that study clearly was that measuring these F2 isoprostanes is far and away the most reliable way to assess oxidative stress status. And some of these sort of assays that people have been using, such as what's called the T-BARS assay. I mean, this is a Hiroshima bomb model of oxidative injury. So the F2 isoprostanes in this model go up like 80-fold. Some of these other assays that people have been using, they didn't go up at all, and a couple, as I remember, even decreased. So basically, I think what this discovery of these F2 isoprostanes was is it really helped move the field from the test tube to what's going on in humans and what's going on is oxidative injury really playing a role in human disease.
Now, Doctor, you don't consider yourself to be an expert in mercury toxicity or the diagnosis or treatment of autism. Is that correct?
Right.
And do you consider yourself to be an expert in the area of oxidative stress and oxidative damage as it relates to various diseases?
Yes.
Now, in addition to your report, your filed as Respondents Exhibit CC, you also listened to the testimony of Dr. Deeth that was presented to this court on May 13th?
Yes.
Now, I want to move on to, if you could just explain in simple terms, and we have some slides about just what oxidative stress is.
Well, we've heard that term, so I thought it might be helpful to actually sort of define what is the concept of oxidation. And I'll start with just saying molecules are made up of several different atoms. And an adult.
Doctor, let me interrupt here.
Sure.
I think we're on
slide
number four here. So as we go from slide to slide, let's record the number. Also, as we get into the substance of your testimony, do bear in mind that you're talking to lay people here. When we get into difficult terms or terms that lay people may not understand, make sure you explain them to us and go as these words that are new to us, pronounce them as precisely as you can so we can understand and follow what's going on. Go ahead, Ms.
If I could add to that, if you would slow down just a little bit, it would help
me. Fast talker. So I tried to make this concept of oxidation, which we heard of during these trials, exactly what it is, why it happens, and what's going on. So I think everybody knows what molecules are. And molecules are made up of atoms. Okay? So there's electrons that orbit the nucleus of atoms, and they orbit them in pairs. One is spinning one way, one is spinning the other way. And so everything is happy because everything is balanced. Now, if something comes along and extracts a single electron from an atom, that's termed oxidation. So extraction of electron is termed oxidation. So what that leaves behind is one unpaired electron. And that electron now is not happy because it's lost its partner. And so what it's going to do is try and find another electron somewhere. And it's very, very unstable when you have an unpaired electron. Very, very unstable, and these compounds are very reactive. They really want to go find another electron. So they'll go extract an electron from another atom, atom in another molecule, and that actually causes a chain reaction that propagates the further oxidation, and it just keeps going and going and going. And I think this is...
Yes, and a free radical then is a molecule that only has one electron, the other one is gone, is that...
Exactly.
And now your next slide, which is going to be slide number five, is on free radical-produced lipid peroxidation and the mechanisms for oxidative damage. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And could you please go through that?
Well, this just sort of depicts what I just said. The L here is a lipid and an H is a hydrogen atom. And so if something, and the R is a radical. So this radical will abstract this hydrogen, which is an electron, from the lipid. And so that will make an RH. What's left behind now is a lipid radical. That dot is a radical, an unpaired electron. There's a lot of oxygen around in the body, so that L dot, or that lipid with an unpaired electron, will immediately react with oxygen. That still leaves a radical as LOO dot. So that LO dot then will go, it's still trying to find another electron. So what it'll do is oxidize like another lipid. So that makes LOOH. That's okay. But what it leaves behind is another L dot, which we can see. Then you start back up here again. And so this just keeps propagating itself until something stops it.
And how do you stop this chain reaction?
I think we go to the next line.
And we're on slide six.
So how do we stop this process? Because it's just a chain reaction. And so the way this can be terminated is by no donation of electron, which is termed reduction. So oxidation is taking electron away. Reduction is donating an electron from, for example, an antioxidant molecule. So you might think, well, that's just going to set up continued propagation. But that's not the case because antioxidant molecules have very unique properties in that the unpaired electron remaining after donating electron in antioxidant molecules is not highly reactive and therefore will not extract another electron from another molecule. And so there the chain reaction is stopped by this antioxidant. So accordingly, the redox status, we've heard that term in these proceedings before, really represents the balance between reduction and oxidation. Which way? And it's a balance and where you are in that balance. So oxidative stress is defined as an imbalance between oxidation and reduction in favor of the former.
Thank you. Now, every human being undergoes oxidative stress. Is that correct?
Right. Our normal process of metabolism, everything, we have a certain amount of oxidative stress. The damage caused by that is kept in check.
And what are some examples that will elicit oxidative stress?
Well, simple things. I mean, you bruise your finger, you're going to have oxidative stress in your finger, but that's repaired. Exercise is even associated. That's well known to actually cause a modest oxidative stress. And actually, a modest oxidative stress can be actually beneficial. because what we have, we're balancing things, like I said, between the amount of oxidation and the amount of reduction. So certainly we have a battery of protective mechanisms, which we call antioxidant enzymes, superoxide dismutase, catalase, glutathione peroxidase.
Can you say that again? You really started to go fast in that last part of the answer.
I'm writing as fast as I can.
Okay. So we have a balance. You know, we are confident there's a certain amount of oxidative stress always going on. So why doesn't that just go rampant? Because we have a battery of protective antioxidant enzymes to keep that in check at a certain level. And I can name these enzymes. So it's how much oxidation going on and how much of this protective mechanism. That's why we don't just oxidize ourselves to death. But we have this constant low-level degree of oxidation going on, but we have these incredible antioxidant defense mechanisms to keep that at bay. Does that make sense?
Yes. So if exercise causes oxidative stress, it doesn't mean I shouldn't go running when it stops raining this afternoon?
No, I mean, that's probably most people think that's what is it behind the beneficial effects of exercise. It's a modest oxidative stress, which then leads to upregulation of all these antioxidant defenses. So that then if you have some oxidant going on, you're already more than prepared to take care of that.
So you're saying basically that oxidative stress has a protective effect. Well, can have a protective effect.
In a modest degree.
And then we'll move on to slide 7. Now, oxidative stress does not necessarily mean no oxidative damage. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And if you could just go through the slide, please.
So you have to say oxidative stress and oxidative damage are two different things.
Can you say that one again?
So oxidative stress doesn't necessarily equate to oxidative damage. Your body senses that this redox status is altered. And what it's trying to do is keep important molecules from becoming oxidatively damaged. So it will upregulate these defenses to keep this at bay. So there's ways you can assess oxidative stress, but that doesn't necessarily equate to oxidative damage per se. Or it'll be a minimal damage that can be readily repaired. So the second one is the fact that the moderate level can be protective. When the body senses it upregulates the synthesis of numerous antioxidant enzymes, which can prevent oxidative damage.
Doctor, when you start pointing at the screen and reading,
okay,
your voice doubles in speed, and we can't get any of it. So,
okay, I actually think
when you get to that part, slow down.
Okay, so I actually think I've just covered these samples.
Okay. Does the finding of oxidative stress in the periphery, the plasma, indicate that there's oxidative stress in the brain?
No.
And why is that?
You know, free radicals, the damage done by free radicals happens where they're generated. As I said, free radicals are very, very reactive. They don't travel around the body and go to the brain. They're going to try to get this electron from what's next door, and they will get it. They don't travel around because they're very, very extremely reactive. So there's all kinds of diseases which we and others have, you know, well-documented, severe sort of oxidative injury in peripheral organs. You know, and these people don't have any central nervous system abnormalities. You know, even we've even looked at graduate students who have elevated cholesterol levels. These are 20-year-old kids who have cholesterol levels above 200. They have higher levels of isoprostanes for whatever reason. Obviously, they're in graduate school. They don't have any problems thinking.
And if there is oxidative stress in the brain, can that be detected by measuring oxidative stress in the periphery?
No, it can't. And for the same reasons I said before, these free radicals don't move around. They're going to react locally with other macromolecules. And in fact, we've done a lot of research into the role of oxidative injury in Alzheimer's disease. And when you look in the brain, we can detect this by looking at brains taken from patients with Alzheimer's disease at autopsy. Or we can see this elevation in these isoprostanes in cerebral spinal fluid taken from the lumbar spine, which is draining the brain. But we've published this as well, that we cannot pick up this oxidative injury that's happening in the brain when we measure isoprostanes in plasma or urine. And we've also, I've got ongoing studies with some people in Dallas where we're looking at people who have very, very severe traumatic brain injury. And the amount of oxidation going in the brain and the spinal fluid that's draining the brain is enormous in these patients. We cannot pick that up in the periphery. We're also studying patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage where they bleed into their brain. And the amount of oxidation there we can pick up in cerebral spinal fluid is very high, and we cannot pick that up in the periphery.
Now, petitioners and petitioners experts here have talked a lot about various biomarkers that they say indicate ongoing oxidative stress. And I just want to ask you a few questions about some of those tests, well, some of the indicators of oxidative stress. And the first is the glutathione and oxidized glutathione balance. Could you just explain what glutathione is? And I think it's referred to as GSH.
Yeah, GSH. And so GSH, if you remember back on my first slide, if you extract electron from GSH, that H, that hydrogen, you're left with GS dot. That's an unpaired electron. So that then, if you've got two GS dots, they will combine and form GSSG. I think Dean Jones, who's going to testify, will get into this in more detail. So so the ratio of GSH to GSSG is a ratio of oxidized glutathione to reduced glutathione.
And in this case, the altered GSH and GSSG ratios have been used to argue that children with autism have chronic oxidative stress, which petitioners have causally implicated in the etiology of autism. Can these altered ratios be indicative of oxidative stress?
They can be indicative of oxidative stress, but they're not necessarily indicative of oxidative damage. Furthermore, these measurements were done in plasma, which said what's going on in the periphery doesn't have any relevance, very little relevance to what's going on in the brain.
And I think you've talked about this earlier on when you were talking about your research and what led you to the discovery of the isoprostanes, but what is the most accurate way then to measure oxidative injury?
I mentioned this before, that this independent study by National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences essentially sort of evaluated the validity of almost every method that's ever been developed to assess oxidative injury. And one in the analysis of F2 isoprostanes far exceeded other things. I mean, some of these assays, like I said before, you know, the isoprostanes went up like 80-fold in this well-established animal model of oxidative injury. Some of these other methods that have been developed, I mean, they went up 20% or something like that.
And so, again, if you did find an elevated level of these F2 isoprostanes in the plasma, would that reflect anything that's going on in the brain?
No.
And were there oxidative damage in the brain? Could that be detected by measurements in the periphery?
No.
Now, in your expert report, you reviewed some of the papers relied upon by Dr. Deeth to prove that there was oxidative stress going on.
Yes.
And I'd just like to go through a couple of those with you.
Okay.
And the first is a Chauhan, 2004, which was petitioner's master list 481. And the authors of that paper measured levels of MDA in plasma by T-bars assay. And I'd like you just to describe that process and let me know if that's a reliable test to determine oxidative damage.
It's totally unreliable, and there's two reasons for it.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to repeat that. I cannot pick that up.
It's totally unreliable. The reason for that is MDA or malondialdehyde is not a specific product of lipid peroxidation, and the T-bars assay used to measure MDA is not specific for MDA. And there's a real problem with using the T-bars assay in plasma. And the reason for that is, so T-bars measures malondialdehyde and some other things. It's not specific.
Measure, what was that word?
T-bars?
T-bars measure something.
Measures MDA, but some other things as well. It's not specific for measuring MDA.
Okay.
Malondialdehyde.
That was the word I
couldn't
think of.
That's the word, and that's what...
MDA.
That's MDA.
MDA is malondialdehyde, right. So the problem is, and the other problem is they measured this in plasma. I'm going to try and make you understand this because it may get a little complicated, but I'll go through it as slow as I can. When you draw blood, so Does everybody know what platelets are?
Yes.
Okay. When you draw blood to isolate plasma, you cannot draw blood without activating platelets. Okay? It just happens. There's little platelets, and you know, they come squeezing through the needle, and they don't like that. They get activated. So one problem is there's this enzyme in platelets called thromboxane synthase. So when you activate platelets, they might start making thromboxane by this enzyme. The problem is for every molecule of thromboxane that this enzyme makes, it also makes one molecule of MDA. It has nothing to do with oxidation. It's an enzymatic product of this enzyme in platelets, which is activated when you draw the blood. So as I said, measuring MDA in plasma, even if you had a very, very specific assay for MDA, would not be reliable as a measure of oxidative stress. But the T-bars is not even reliable to measure MDA.
And the other
big problems with measuring a T-bars assay in plasma. It's totally unreliable.
And the other study that you reviewed was Ming 2005, which is Petitioner's Master List 124. And this also was relied upon by Dr. Deeth. And in that Ming test, they measured F2 isoprostanes with immunoassays as evidence of oxidative damage in autistic children. And if you could just go through the type of test that was performed and whether that is reliable.
Well, we do our analyses for isoprostanes by mass spectrometry. I'm sure there's many people who don't know what mass spectrometry is. It requires a very sophisticated instrument, which costs several hundred thousand dollars. But it's the most accurate way to probably measure anything. So immunoassays is where somebody develops an antibody against some analyte, whatever that is. Usually it's proteins. And that binds to it. So you can measure certain compounds using an immunoassay. And this gets back to, but as I said, these isoprostanes are small lipid molecules. They're not big proteins. Antibodies against big proteins are usually much more specific than trying to make antibodies to small molecules such as lipids. And these isoprostanes are lipids. So when I was in the prostaglandin field, they developed immunoassays for prostaglandins. Remember, the isoprostanes are prostaglandin-like compounds. And
would you say that last sentence again?
Take a short recess here. We're going to try to swap out your mic, doctor. We're getting feedback, which is also interfering with us hearing, so we can go off the record for 5 minutes or so.
Testing. Okay.
That's much better. We're not getting the feedback.
All right, let's go ahead and go back on the record, and I'll just ask again, doctor, please try to slow down. I know you're giving us some important testimony here. We want to actually understand it.
Okay. Do my best. So we were talking about immunoassays for isoprostanes. So when I started this, I want to make it clear, I hope I made it clear, that isoprostanes are prostaglandin-like compounds, okay, which are very small lipid molecules. So when you have immunoassays, you have an antibody and it binds to a certain analyte, and you can measure how much the binding is and therefore quantitate whatever you're trying to measure with an antibody. And most antibodies are against things, big molecules such as proteins or something. But isoprostanes are small lipids, very small molecular weight. And when I was in the prostaglandin field, people tried for years and years to try to develop a reliable, accurate measure, immunoassay for measuring prostaglandins, and essentially it never happened. They tried all kinds of distortions and all kinds of ways to do this. Sometimes they would extract samples, and sometimes that made it worse, sometimes it made it better. So there's a lot of interfering substances in biological fluids, such as plasma and urines, which can interfere with this antibody binding. So basically, companies sell these immunoassay kits because they make money, but the reliability is very, very questionable. Aside from that, given the fact that, which I've talked about before, measuring something in the plasma tells you nothing about what's going on in the brain. So even if this immunoassay that they use measuring isoproteins in the plasma was reliable, which it probably, I won't say it wasn't because I don't know for sure, but most immunoassays for small lipids and isoproteins that have been developed, and we've shown that, are not reliable. That tells you nothing about what's going on in the brain.
Thank you. Have you done in vitro studies on oxidative stress?
Yes.
And you've also done animal studies on oxidative stress?
Yes,
and several. Human studies?
Yes.
And do you have an opinion on the value of extrapolating in vitro data to what occurs in vivo?
It's very, 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 very difficult. I think we've already heard that at this, is you can use cell culture systems as an initial hint of whether you might want to do something else. But you can't extrapolate. These cells in culture are already transformed. Most cells, you know, if you took a cell out of your brain, a neuron, and put it in culture, it's going to die. So these are not normal cells, and the culture conditions are not normal. So extrapolating what you might find in a cell culture system to what happens in vivo, you can't. It's just an initial hint, should we look further or not. So, you know, that's a lead. And then usually, you know, you will go, if you've had an animal model, if you're interested in some disease, we'll set up an animal model of that disease. A lot of animal models of disease don't actually accurately mimic, at least in total, what's going on in a human disease, and that's known to be problems. So that's a stepwise sort of fashion. Then you sort of evaluate if there is one, an animal model of ex-human disease, and if things look positive, then what you really absolutely in the end need to do is look at humans. And I'm a sort of a translational science. I do very basic research, but I go to humans as fast as I possibly can because that's where the real answer is.
And in your opinion, do the studies relied upon by Dr. Deeth show, more likely than not, that autistic children have oxidative stress in the brain?
No.
So even if Dr. Deeth and Dr. Mumper are correct, namely that there is evidence of oxidative stress in children with autism, with findings in the periphery, is there any way to discern the cause of that stress?
No.
Why is that?
As I said, I mean, it can happen from all kinds of different things, such as even modest exercise. And so all we can say is in these kids, and maybe poor nutrition, these children aren't normal children. And I can imagine their dietary habits or intake is not completely normal. They get up from the table and they go somewhere. And, you know, it could be we have to take in certain small antioxidant enzymes, such as we just all heard about, vitamin C, vitamin E. We have to take these in from our diet. And so it's conceivable, maybe it's all speculation, but maybe some of these children, their nutrition is not adequate, so their amount of vitamin C, vitamin E, and other antioxidants they have to ingest may not be normal.
And is oxidative stress indicative of oxidative injury?
No. Well, I might say that, you know, an oxidative stress may cause a minimal amount of oxidant injury, but that can be protective because then that leads to this upregulation of all these antioxidant defense enzymes and mechanisms to keep this whole process in check from getting out of hand.
And would that finding tell you anything about what is going on in the brain?
No.
Are there any specific biomarkers for mercury-induced oxidative stress?
Not that I know of.
And finally, Doctor, in your 20 years of experience working in the field of oxidative stress, in your opinion, is there reliable evidence to conclude that autism is caused by oxidative stress?
I see none.
In your opinion here today, do you believe that that reflects what's generally accepted by researchers in the area of oxidative stress?
Yeah, I mean, our sort of free radical society, the Society for Free Radical Biology and Medicine, I can't even remember. I can't say that there wasn't some abstract submitted on that, but it's certainly not something that's even discussed in the people by the in the field.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Petitioners have any questions here?
Very few.
Please go ahead.
Good morning, Dr. Johnson.
Roberts.
Let me ask you, do you think there are, is there any way that researchers trying to treat autism could measure oxidative stress in the periphery to see if it was going on in the brain?
No.
No way to do it at all. Spinal fluid, maybe.
Yes.
Do you understand that the general theory that Dr. Kinsborn presented here is that the persistence of inorganic mercury in the brain of these children leads to active chronic neuroinflammation, which then can explain the symptoms of autism according to a number of published papers. Do you agree that neuroinflammation can explain the symptoms of autism?
I'm going to object. This was beyond the scope of his direct. He was offering an opinion on Dr. Dietz's testimony.
Mr. Reed?
Well, let me withdraw the question then. Do you can neuroinflammation in the brain cause oxidative stress?
Yes, it can, up to a certain extent. It depends how severe the inflammation is. And, you know, that doesn't say this oxidative stress may not, depending on the severity. There's a gradation, as I've tried to explain, and we have defense mechanisms that may not necessarily translate into oxidative damage.
And oxidative damage could be a loss of function, not just cell death, correct?
Yes.
Would inorganic mercury inside neurons cause oxidative stress in those neurons?
Again, beyond the scope of his direct, and also he said that he's not an expert in mercury.
Well, that question, let's see if he can answer. If he can't answer it, then he'll tell us that. Well, go ahead and
repeat your question, sir.
Repeat that.
Can inorganic mercury inside neurons cause oxidative stress to the neuron?
I don't know that.
Okay. You mentioned autopsy studies of Alzheimer's patients, which do show oxidative stress in those people, correct?
And oxidative damage.
Have you reviewed any of the autopsy studies of autistics?
No.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Any redirect for this witness?
No, thank you.
All right. Dr. Roberts, we're sorry we stuck you with a bad microphone for the beginning of your testimony. I thank Special
Master
Ball for figuring that out. I didn't, but we thank you very much for your testimony. You're excused at this time.
Thanks.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're not excused. my mistake. Special Master Campbell Smith.
Dr. Roberts, I did have a question. I heard you testify on Cross that neuroinflammation can cause oxidative stress, and your testimony was depending on the level of neuroinflammation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you give some general, without perhaps specific numbers, but when you say depending on the level, would that have to be substantial neuroinflammation that will cause oxidative stress?
I mean, it's a continuum of things where a small amount can be protective. And the only way to answer that question would be if you had absolutely firm evidence that there was oxidative damage at some level of inflammation, because, you know, leukocytes try to kill bugs by making hydrogen peroxide.
Can you say that sentence again?
So when you have inflammation like leukocytes, I mean, they try to kill bacteria by making oxidants like in hydrogen peroxide. But as I tried to, the point I tried to make across, there's a continuum of all this. And so your question is, I think, by and large, a little bit unanswerable, because where does this amount of inflammation turn into oxidative damage rather than not?
Well, that's you're anticipating a question.
Oh.
And maybe you're thinking a step ahead of me. What we've been hearing is there is a chronic level of neuroinflammation.
Right.
That leads to oxidative stress. Oxidative stress that is sufficient to cause damage that looks like a loss of cell function as opposed to cell death. I've heard you testify that there is a chronic level of oxidative stress that exists at all times that can be handled by upregulated antioxidants. And that does not necessarily translate into damage, which would be, in your definition, damage is alteration of cell function and cell death? Or is it just the, because it appeared when you said that there you can cause damage, but if the body can handle it and the self-protective mechanisms can repair it,
correct,
you don't really regard that as a damage?
That's correct.
Okay. So I think you might have been anticipating my next question. I recognize it may be unanswerable, but we're floating in a level of where is the difference between just what is oxidative stress that the body, its own system, is able to handle, and when do we begin to veer into
damage.
What you regard as damage?
Well, the only way to know where you're on that curve is to actually measure and quantify the level of oxidative damage. So you don't know, and it may vary between one person or another person. I don't know what happened to my... Anyway, so there's a continuum, and you don't know where you're on that continuum unless you measure a product of oxidative damage. It's too hypothetical to know where you're on this curve. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay.
It does. Okay.
And there's, you know, you have to say, is there oxidative damage, and actually accurately quantify the level of oxidative damage and see if it's increased. You don't know where you are on that curve, because how much in this person your antioxidant defenses are upregulated because of this low level of stress, you don't know. And so you have to, the only way you know where you are on that curve is to measure how much damage is being done.
And you can only do that. You cannot do that in the periphery.
That's correct.
You don't understand what's happening in the brain.
That's correct.
Thank you.
No, wait a minute, doctor.
That did provoke.
Yes, please.
One more quick line of questions.
Okay.
When we speak of oxidative damage in the brain, there's been evidence here that in monkeys exposed to inorganic mercury leads to inflammation, neuroinflammation, and astrocyte death. If astrocytes die as a result of neuroinflammation, can that lead, as Dr. Deeth told us, to a lowering of glutathione in the brain?
I'm going to object again, because it's beyond the scope of this direct. I think it's beyond the scope of the questions from the bench as well.
Well, I'm going to let him. Why don't you ask the question again? I'll let him answer okay. That.
One of the things Dr. Deeth testified to was that neuroinflammation in the brain can lead to dysfunction, even death of astrocytes. Dysfunction and death of astrocytes can lead to a lowering of glutathione, which then leads to a chronic inability to restore the redox balance in the brain. My question to you is, do you agree that that is a plausible mechanism?
Well, I would ask, do we know what caused the cell death? Is it really oxidative damage? You know that cells are dying in the brains of these children with autism, but do you know the mechanism?
Well, I'm asking you.
You would have to have measurements of oxidative injury in those brains.
And you haven't reviewed the autopsy studies?
No.
Okay.
Anything further, Ms. Renzi?
Just one question.
Please, go ahead. Doctor, you stay there until we tell you. Each time one of us asks a question, that means the rest get to respond to that.
Fine.
I'll make this very short. Is there a difference between oxidative stress, oxidative damage, and oxidative damage that has consequences?
Yes, as I said, I mean, these isoprostanes, which are indicative of oxidative damage to lipids. I can measure those in your plasma. And there's a normal level of oxidative damage to all of our macromolecules, proteins, and everything else. But that's kept at a level that doesn't hurt us. It's only when we can't keep it at that level and it starts to sort of fly away, or then we get more damage, and that's when you can get into trouble with cells dying, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams, anything further? Special masters, anything?
Can I leave?
Going once, going twice. Doctor, thank you again. All right. Is the government ready to call its next witness?
I believe if we have about a, they're in the building, as I understand. They're just not in the courtroom right now. If we had about a 10-minute break.
Let's take a 10-minute break.
Switch out here.